I see you, Bakela. Gandang stepped from the dark and silent ranks. I see you, Gandang. The king's messenger has arrived. Gandang paused a moment, solemn and stern, and then his perfectly square white teeth gleamed in the grey of dawn as he smiled. The king has given you the road and bids you attend him at Tabas in Dunas. The two men grinned at each other with relief. For both of them it meant life. The king had determined that Gandang had done his duty and correctly interpreted his commands, while Zuga had been accepted as an emissary and not as an enemy. We will march at once, Gandang smiled still, before the sun. The king's summons brooked of no hesitations or delays. Safari, Zuga roused his camp. We march at once. A natural delicacy and tact had made Gandang keep little Juba out of sight and hearing of Zuga's camp. Nor had he mentioned the girl's name to Zuga, while sentence of death still hung over the white man. However, that first night of the journey to Tabas and Dunas, after they had camped, he brought Juba to Zuga's hut, and she knelt and greeted him as Baba father, and then, with Gandang seated between them and listening attentively, he allowed them to talk for a short while. Zuga was avid for news of his sister, and he listened in silence to the account of Fuller Ballantyne's death and his burial. It was better this way, and Zuga was already preparing his own fulsome tributes to the memory of his father. While relieved also to hear that Robin was safe, Zuga was less happy with the swift progress she seemed to be making. It must have been nearly 3 months since Juba last saw her, almost within sight of the eastern mountain range, and by this time Robin must have surely reached the coast and could be on board a Portuguese trade ship well on her way to Good Hope and the Atlantic. He did not know how long he would be delayed by the Matabele king, and then how long the overland journey down half the length of Africa might take him. Robin's manuscript could be in London a year or even more before his own. Zuga had exchanged one worry for another, and on the following day's march he chivied his porters, heavily laden though they were, to keep up with their captors. It was of little avail, and they struggled along behind the trotting impi, until Zuga demanded of Gandang that his own bearers be ordered to help with the load of ivory and the even greater, weightier package of bark and plaited grass, which contained the granite bird which Zuga had plundered from the tomb of the kings. With each day's travel towards the west, so the land became drier, and the forests thinned out and gave way to level pasturage, with sparsely dotted acacias, graceful mushroom-shaped trees from whose branches hung the big, protein-rich, bean-shaped pods so dearly loved by game and domestic animals alike. The relief from the driving and endless rainstorms lifted their spirits, and the impi sang on the march, winding like a thick black serpent through the lovely park-like lands below the bald and rounded kopjes of granite. Soon they came across the first of the king's herds, the small humpback cattle whose origins lay far back beyond the veils of history. Perhaps it had taken them and their drovers 4,000 years to travel down from the valley of the Nile, or from the fertile plains enclosed by the twin rivers of the Euphrates and the Tigris. The cattle were sleek, for the grass was dense and sweet. Even here, in the drier lands, the rains had been good. The animals were of every colour and pattern, chocolate red and black and white and yellow, piebald and skewbald, solid black or pure snowy white. They watched with a blank bovine stare as the column of men trotted past, and the small herd boys, naked except for the tiny apron of the beshu, came scampering to stare in silent, wide-eyed awe at the fighting men in plume and tassel, for they were already pining for the day that they would be called into their own regiments, and in turn follow the warrior's road. They reached the first of the Matabele towns. It was situated on the banks of the Inyati River. Gandang explained that it was the headquarters of his own impi, the Inyati impi, and that it was not the largest of the regimental towns. The settlement was laid out around the central cattle pen, a vast enclosure large enough to hold 10,000 head of the king's herds. The dwellings were of identical thatched beehive construction, in the tradition that the wandering tribe had preserved since leaving their native Zululand. The outer stockade was of cut mopani poles set deep in the earth and forming a stout defensive wall. The villagers streamed out to welcome the returning impi, lining both sides of the route, a singing, clapping and laughing throng, mostly of women and children. "Most of the men and the marriageable maidens have left already for Tabas in Dunas. In the full of this moon, the Chawala dance begins, and all the nation will assemble at the king's kraal. We will rest here only one night, and then take the road again to reach Tabas in Dunas before the moon." The road from the Inyati River westwards was now a populous highway, as the nation went in towards the king's capital city to celebrate the festival of the first fruits. The men marched in their regiments, their distinctive dress and ornaments, the colour of their war shields identifying each from afar, from the scarred and silver-headed veterans who had fought the Basutu, the Griquas, and the Boer in the south, to the young bloods, eager for their first kill, eager to learn in which direction the king would hurl his war spear at the conclusion of the Chawala. For that was the direction in which they would find their reputation, their manhood, their glory, and possibly their deaths. The regiments of young unmarried women interspersed those of the warriors, and as they passed each other on the road, the girls preened and giggled, casting languorous slow eyes at the unmarried men, and the men pranced and leapt in the pantomime of battle. The Gia, showing how they would wash their spears in blood and earn the privilege to go in to the women and take wives. With each day's march towards Tabas in Dunas, the roads became more congested and their pace was reduced by the throng. They might wait half a morning to take their turn across a ford of the river, for the regiments drove the cattle, which were their food supply, ahead of them, and dragged their baggage train behind. Each warrior's finery, his tassels and plumes and feathers, were carefully packed and carried by the young apprentice who was his personal bearer. At last, in the sweltering noon of high summer, Zuga's little party, still borne along on the river of humanity, came over a crest of ground and saw laid out ahead of them the great kraal and capital city of the Matabele. It was spread out over many square miles of open plain below the bald-headed granite hills that gave it its name, the Hills of the Chieftains. The furthest hill was the place of the killing, Bulawayo, and from its sheer cliffs those condemned to die were cast down. The stockades formed concentric circles, dividing the city into separate parts. Always the huge open cattle pens were the centre of Matabele life, their cattle the source and store of their wealth. And now that the outlying herds had been brought in for the festival, every pen was filled with the multicoloured herds of fat beasts. Standing at Zuga's shoulder, Gandang used his stabbing spear to point out with pride the city's features. There were sections for the unmarried girls and the unblooded regiments, and another huge area for the married quarters. The huts were uniform in size and laid out in orderly patterns, the thatched roofs shining golden yellow in the sunlight. The earth between them was swept clean and beaten hard by the passage of bare feet. "There is the king's hut," Gandang pointed out a single huge conical structure in its own separate enclosure. "And that is the compound of the king's wives." 100 other huts, within a high guarding stockade, and it is death to any man who enters that gate. Gandang led Zuga down to a small grove of acacia trees outside the main stockade. There was a stream within a few yards of it, and for the first time in days they were free of the close press of humanity. Although the plain without the city walls was thick with the temporary dwellings of the visiting impis, the area around the grove was empty, as if it had been placed out of bounds to the common people. "When will I see the king?" Zuga asked. "Not until after the festival," Gandang answered. There is a ritual and cleansing that the king must undergo. But he has sent you gifts. You are much honored. And he pointed with his blade at the line of young maidens that left a gate in the stockade. Each girl carried a large earthenware pot balanced easily upon her head, and she did not use a hand to maintain that balance. The girls moved with that peculiar straight-backed grace, hips swinging in lazy rhythm, the hard, unripe fruits of their breasts bouncing and jostling at each pace. They came into Zuga's little camp in the grove and knelt to offer the gifts they bore. Some pots contained thick millet beer, tart and effervescent. Others, the clotted and soured cow's milk, imas, that was so much a staple of the Nguni diet. And others again, big chunks of fatty beef roasted on the open coals. "You are much honoured by these gifts," Gandang repeated, apparently himself surprised by the king's generosity. "Yet Chedi, your grandfather, was always his good and trusted friend." Once the camp was set up, Zuga found himself again the victim of idleness, with long days of waiting to fill. Here, however, he was free to roam about the city and its surrounds, save only for the forbidden areas of the royal enclosure and women's quarters. He sketched the fascinating bustle of preparation for the festival. During the heat of the day, the banks of the rivers were lined with men and women, their velvety black skins shimmering with water as they bathed and cleansed themselves for the dances. Every tree for miles about was hung with the kilts and furs, the feathers and plaited ornaments that were airing. The creases and rumples of travel and packing were being allowed to drop out of them as they billowed and flapped in the light breeze. He passed groups of young girls plaiting each other's hair, smearing and rubbing each other's bodies with oil and coloured clays, and they giggled and waved at Zuga as he passed. At first, the problem of hygiene that this huge assembly presented puzzled Zuga, until he realized that there was an area of thick undergrowth beyond the city walls where both men and women went at dawn and in the short twilight. This area had its own population of crows and kites, of jackal and hyena, that served as the city's cleansing service. Interested further in the running of the city, he found that all bathing and washing of clothing was allowed only below a certain spot on the river banks, marked by a distinctively large tree or other feature, and that the women filled the water pots for drinking and cooking above this point. Even the huge cattle pen, in its very heart, helped to keep the city clean. It acted as a vast fly-trap. The insects laid their eggs on the fresh cattle dung, but before they could hatch, most of them were deeply trampled by the hooves of the milling herds. The brilliant sunlight and the untainted wind completed the process of keeping the area relatively clean, and the smells interesting, but not unbearable. Zuga should have been content to have reached this haven, instead of leaving his assegai-riven corpse for a hyena's feast in the wilderness. But he was not. He set himself tasks to fill the waiting days. He drew sketches and maps of the city, noting weaknesses in the fortifications, and where an attack would have the best chance of penetrating these and reaching the king's private quarters. He sketched the uniforms of the various impis. He noted the colours of their shields and other means of identifying them in the field. Asking innocent-seeming questions of Gandang, he was able to estimate the number of warriors each regiment contained, the ages and battle experience of the warriors, the names and personal idiosyncrasies of their indunas, and the location of their regimental towns.